Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. Thank you for tuning in. We are coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. You can hear a new program every Thursday and Sunday. And you can, of course, access our radio archive 24/7 through our website, redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. And today we have researcher Nasim Haramain with us. We have a lot of requests to invite Nasim to the program, and I've been catching up with much of the information that he has available on his website, theresonanceproject.org, theresonanceproject.org. And we're going to address a variety of many interesting subject matters here today. We're basically going to dive into the search, if you will, for a grand unified field theory. We're going to talk about everything from geometry to the power of spin, the structure of the universe, and much, much more. And Nasim has a fascinating theory that we're going to explore further here today. He also has a beautiful trailer up on his website for the DVD called Crossing the Event Horizon. I'm going to ask Nasim a little bit more about that later in the program. But let's start at the top, as it were, and bring our guest first on the program here. So with that, welcome to Red Ice Creation, Nasim, all the way from Hawaii. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be on your program.
Brilliant. Thank you again for coming on and spending some of your time with us. I know that you're very busy over there in Hawaii, involved in a lot of interesting research, for sure. Why don't we do like this, Nasim, for listeners that might not be familiar with you or your research, if you will, tell us a little bit about your background and how you have got involved in the kind of research that you do here today.
For many years when I was young, at some moments of revelations from my earlier time in studying at school, moments where I thought of things that didn't seem to match what I was being taught in the schools. And one of my first inkling to understanding the geometry of the structure of the vacuum and came from a first class I had in geometry when I was about 10 years old, and I realized that there was some deficiency in our understanding of dimensions, and from there on I started to search for a better understanding of how reality comes together, how atoms self-organize in all this complexity we call our biosphere, and
right.
And how consciousness gets involved as well, and how matter and energy interact to produce our world. So it's been a long time, a long road of research, all through advanced physics, chemistry, biology, and eventually I wrote a unified field theory by modifying Einstein field equations, and wrote a bunch of papers on this, and I'm currently doing research in the context of a research park we call the Resonance Project.
Interesting. And tell us a little bit about this, the Resonance Project. Is it a big organization? Do you guys have classes and things like this?
It's a non-profit organization that is situated on the Big Island of Hawaii, where we have various researchers, scientists, and from many different fields, from physics to biology and engineers and so on, and we are actively doing research in bringing this unified view to the world and advancing it and bringing more and more levels of clarity to it and helping produce material to educate the public and let the public know about the possibilities, both in science and technology and philosophy that comes from this new view of physics, which is gaining more and more popularity right now. So it's very exciting. It's a great group of people, and we do it in the context of a research park that is on land, on the land that where we grow food and all this, and so it's a sustainable community. And it allows us to work together, think together, you know, and live together. And, you know, sometimes you have great ideas at 3 a.m. and you got to talk to your friend researchers. And
right.
It's great to have everybody on site.
Oh, that's a good idea. It sounds very interesting. So how long have you been running this research park over there?
The research park has been here for, about 4 years or 3.5 years now.
Mm.
And we have intern programs that people can participate in, and volunteers. And as well, we have various programs like an emissary program, where people come here for a week and a half and they get trained, like 10 days, and they get trained in being able to understand the deeper levels of the theory and being able to go out there and give talks about it and educate the public.
Right, right. So, Nassim, if you will, kind of lead us into the subject. I actually don't know where is a good place to begin. I mean, we could, I guess, give an overview of how this grand unified field theory came about. I don't know if you want to go into it that way or what do you think? Give us your suggestion here.
yeah, absolutely. We could start where I started when I was 10 years old. And,
right.
And, you know, go from there, because I think it's a fairly organic way of thinking, and it helps the listeners follow the information.
Sounds good.
So, yeah, basically when I was 10 or so, I went to my first geometry class, and the teacher went to the blackboard and made a little dot on the board and said, today we're going to learn about dimensions, which is the first class in geometry. And the little dot I just made is called dimension zero, and it doesn't exist. And, you know, I don't know about you, most people had that class at one point or another, and, you know, already when the first statement was made, which is an axiom, the first axiom was made, I already had a problem with it. I knew I was going to have an issue with that class, because...
Yeah.
I could see the dot on the blackboard, so how could it not exist?
Right, right.
And so, you know, then from there, the teacher put a bunch of dots together to make a line and said, this line is called dimension one, and it doesn't exist either because it still doesn't enclose volume. And then he took four of these lines and made a plane, like a square, and said, this is dimension two. It's a flat dimension. It doesn't enclosed space, so it still doesn't exist. And then the teacher did something miraculous. He took six of these planes and made them into a cube and draw a cube on the blackboard and said, this is dimension three, and this one exists because it enclosed space.
Right.
However, you can't enclose space with a plane that doesn't exist, that's made out of lines that don't exist, that are made out of dots that don't exist. So for me, right away, I could see there was an error there. I could see there was a problem.
Yeah.
And if I, you know, for me it was clear, even at that young of age, that if we didn't understand dimensions, if we didn't understand the basics of geometry, there was a good chance we weren't going to be able to understand the physics of how creation comes about or the mathematics of it. And it wasn't until much later that I realized that all of our physics and all of our mathematics is based on these on this axiom. And a lot of it is written in flat space. And so I basically went home that night when I was 10, and I thought about it, and I eventually came to realize that the only way to solve the riddle is to take the exact contrary approach, and that is that the only thing that exists is the point.
Yeah.
That within the point, within dimension zero, is all possibilities, that everything emerges from a point and returns to a point. And, you know, that's not necessarily contrary to the concept of a Big Bang, where, you know, all of the universe came out of a teeny dot smaller than an atom, and, you know, and returns to it eventually. And so I didn't know all this, but I just thought, oh my God, you know, I could imagine that if I looked at the Earth from far, you know, or the bus that was bringing me home from far, that it would look like a dot, and then eventually the Earth would look like a dot, and if I look further, the solar system would look like a dot, and the galaxy would look like a dot, and so on. And then I could imagine that all the cells in my hand would look like dots, and then if I flew in one of those, I could see that it would be made out of billions of little atoms that would look like dots, and that these atoms were probably made out of smaller dots in the center, and so on. And I thought, oh, it's dots all the way up and all the way down.
Yeah, it depends. It depends on your perspective in a way, then.
Yes, it depends on your perspective. It's scale dependent.
Mm.
And so basically the universe makes little dots and then assembles the dots together to generate all the complexity we see. But that the source of all of this is this point, which eventually I came to call a singularity, which is a little point of infinite density,
mm,
or a mini black hole. And so I started to think that, you know, everybody in the bus I was in was made out of smaller dot that were made out of smaller dot and so on to infinity. And I started to think, oh, everything has this infinity within it. And I got really excited. And I talked to my mother about it, and she had some objections. And her objection is, like, if everything is infinite, how is it that they seem to be finite? Like, the a table doesn't seem to have infinity in it, or
sure,
or the pen I'm holding, and all these things. And it took me back. It took me a while to figure out how infinities and finite system could be compatible. And I didn't know at the time, but this is a fundamental question in physics. It's actually one of the biggest riddles in current advanced physics. How is it that infinities and finite systems interact? We have a theory for all the big things in our universe that tells us that it seems to be a continuum. This theory is Einstein field equations. It's very renowned. It has shown to be very appropriate and exact in many ways.
Mm.
And then we have a theory for the small things, like anything smaller than a molecule, like atoms and subatomic particles, that's called quantum theory, that tells us that everything is quantized, that it has finite boundaries.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the two don't agree, because one says it's a continuum and the other one says it's finite and it has boundaries.
Right.
And that's a big chasm in our physics. And since this physics have been written for almost 100 and some years, we've been looking for a unification theory, a theory that would unify the big with the small.
Right.
Because obviously, big things are made out of small things.
That's right.
So it was obvious to me that there must be a theory, there must be an understanding, and although I didn't know all this complexity about advanced physics and all this, I felt like I had to find a way to put infinities and finite systems together.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, I came to it. And I came to it through geometry. I started to study a lot of geometry. Interestingly, I studied a lot of ancient texts, and many of the ancient texts talk about geometry. I study ancient schools of thoughts, like the Pythagorean schools, the Platonic schools, and all this. And I came to realize that there's a set of geometry, a very specific set of geometry, that produce fractal systems,
mm-hmm,
that in which infinities and finite systems are interacting together in a compatible way, where you need a boundary to define infinities, and you need infinities to define boundaries. And so the listeners could, if they have a pen and a piece of paper, they could doodle this, but I'm going to try to explain it without visuals, which is a little difficult. But
sure, sure.
If you make a circle on a piece of paper,
Right.
And you were to put a triangle in it. And then you put a reverse triangle, you have something like a star, a six-pointed star in a circle.
Right.
Or like a Star of David in a circle.
Sure.
And so imagine that you went to each of the corner of that star and you made a smaller triangle. You could get smaller Stars of David to appear. And so you could make like little Stars of David inside that big Star of David, and each of these little stars would have a little boundary around it, a little circle around it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could do smaller circles again on that smaller Star of David and get smaller, smaller Stars of David, and you could put a circle around that and get another boundary. Those would be resolutions in the structure of the fractal systems. Each one defines a scale. And you can continue to do that to infinity, meaning if you give that program to a computer and you said to the computer every 5 iterations, zoom in to one of those boundaries and mm-hmm. then continue and then zoom in again and then continue and zoom in and continue, the computer could continue to do this to infinity. Yet, you would never, ever, ever, ever exceed the first boundary that you've made for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The first circles you've made. So, within the confine of a circle, which could be a sphere, you could do it with a sphere and tetrahedrons.
Yeah.
You can put infinite amount of divisions. You can put infinite amount of information with it. Within what seems to be a finite space.
So this is it a little bit similar to like the Mandelbrot set that you can just go into it and into it and into it?
Yes, absolutely. And the geometry of it and how it divides, you know, it's seemed to be intuitively correct at first, you know, and the reason is because when you look in nature, nature seems to do things that way. If you look at the branches of a tree, if you look at the way flowers emerge, it seems that fractal systems are found in nature everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to me, that was a very important clue, that nature probably uses some of these fractal concepts to produce creation. But what intrigued me was, where would that be? Meaning, where is the geometry coming from?
Right.
Like how... Go ahead.
Oh, no, I just said right, so please go ahead.
Yeah. How does it emerge? And, you know, where is it coming from? And so that took me longer. I had to start studying a lot of physics and all this. And eventually, I realized that when we think of reality, we think of reality as what's there, like, for instance, a tree, a plant, a house, a phone, a wallet, whatever is around,
yeah.
You say, oh, that is there, yeah. That is real. However, you know, for instance, we know that there's all sorts of electromagnetic fields and all this that you don't see, but or you don't experience directly, but that doesn't mean they're not real. For instance, we know that if they're strong enough, they can do all sorts of real things, including carrying information across long distances, you know, radios, televisions, and all this.
Yeah.
So there's an unseen reality that has real physical effects as well. Well, I started to realize as I studied physics that there may be another level of unseen reality that we don't directly experience. And that reality, that level of energy and structure would be what is called the vacuum, meaning
okay.
that we think of what's between things as emptiness, but there's not really any reason to think of it that way that we could just as well think of what's between in between things as fullness. And that the things we call reality just emerge from the vacuum and returns to the vacuum, from emerge from that fullness and returns to that fullness. And maybe if I can give you a visual, you could think of water in a pool. And if I pushed a plate in the water in the pool, I would make two little vortices on each side, two little vortex, two little swirls. And they would be spinning in opposite direction. And if, you know, I could say, oh, there's a swirl, but the swirl is just a dynamic in the water of the pool. And if I didn't know that the water of the pool was there, and I could only see the dynamic, I would only think that that's the only thing that exists. I wouldn't know about the water.
Right.
And why would I miss the water? Well, how would we miss the fullness of space? Well, because space is everywhere. The atom is made out of 99.99999% space.
Yeah.
And so what we call reality is a little bit of a jiggle in the space. And we call that an atom. And we call that reality. And we say, oh, there it is.
So what?
But it could be just a dynamic of the space itself.
So what you're saying here is that the physical reality is an effect of something that is occurring in the vacuum.
Exactly. And that it emerges from the vacuum and returns to the vacuum.
Right.
Let's go back to our plate example in the pool. If you push a plate in the pool, you'll get two little vortices on each side. Now, if you look under the water, you'll find that the two vortices are connected by a string of air under the water. If you put your hand between that string of air, the vortices will disappear. And you'll think that the energy is gone, that the dynamics is gone. But if you take your hand out again, then they can reappear. And so what I'm saying is that I believe that, and, you know, the physics I've written supports that, that actually reality is blinking in and out of the vacuum at a very high rate.
Right.
And that and just like a movie, which appears continuous when it's run at the right speed, but if you look at the movie itself, at the film, you can see it's a piece of, it's an image with a space, with an image, with a space, with an image, with a space, and when you run it fast enough, it appears continuous. I believe that matter, and we know, for instance, that the electron and the positron exchange across the, you know, blink in and out. That matter is blinking in and out at an extremely high rate into the vacuum and out of the vacuum and into the vacuum and out of the vacuum. And because the vacuum is everywhere, when it blinks in, it informs the vacuum. And when it blinks out, it experiences the world. And then blinks it, and then it blinks in the vacuum again and informs the vacuum, and then blinks out again, and so the vacuum is constantly informed of everything that's going on.
Very interesting.
And go ahead.
Oh yeah, I just said very interesting. I mean, that would suggest that it's a cycle rate or a specific frequency going on here. Then is that correct?
Yes, and that the cycle is at the speed of light.
Speed of light, okay.
Yes, and that's why we experience it as a limit. And that this cycle rate, this very high rate of information transfer, is self-organizing all things. That because the universe, because the vacuum is everywhere, and as soon as it receives information, it knows what's going on, it self-organizes in a very rapid way, and that explains many things in physics that are unexplained. For instance, how is it that our planet produced so high level of complexity so rapidly since the Big Bang? You know, people may think 14 billion years is a long time, you know, but when we look at our planet, it's much shorter than 14 billion years, and we have, you know, extreme complexity in biology that is available to us everywhere. And in order, if we did mathematical analysis of that, you know, just by random function, the probability of all this coming together in such a wonderful, organized way is extremely low.
Right.
In fact, you know, it's impossible. And, you know, even for just one blade of grass to come together with all the complexity that's involved in it, it would take more than 14 billion years for that to happen, just by random function.
Right, right.
So the tendency when we say that is for the religious people to say, it's God that organized it all.
Sure.
And what I'm proposing is that, no, there's just a feedback dynamic in space-time that produced self-organizing systems. And that feedback, you know, is what puts everything together and takes everything apart. And when, when it self-organizes, it goes towards higher and higher levels of complexity very rapidly, because it knows what everything is doing. So it knows what works and what doesn't work.
So when you say that, that suggests that it might have started out very chaotic then, and it's moving towards a higher degree of order. Is that right?
Yes, that it always moves towards higher degrees of orders and higher degrees of complexity, which, you know, may seem to contradict the laws of thermodynamics, which says that things always go towards disorder.
Yeah.
But this is what the conflict is in physics, is that our law says that everything goes towards more disorder. So since the Big Bang, things should have decayed. But when we look at our planet, we can see that things have gone towards higher and higher levels of complexity and order. Let me give you an example. For instance, in a human being, if I took all the DNA that's inside a human being and put it end to end, you could grab that DNA and wrap it around the world 5 million times. So this is how much DNA that's inside a human being, completely self-organizing. There's about 100 trillion cells in the human body, completely, you know, communicating across, you know, large distances relative to a cell, you know, between your toes and your hairs. Everything is making sure that everything's functioning properly, that your toe cells don't start making nose cells, and your nose cells are not making toe cells, and, you know, everything is communicating and highly organized.
Sure.
And so what I'm saying is that there is a underlying organization, there's an underlying structure in the vacuum itself. And when we look in quantum theory, in order for all of our physics to work in quantum theory, there is a very important part that's not talked about much, and that is that the vacuum cannot be empty. The vacuum inside atom has to be fluctuating with energy in order for all of our predictions to be true, and all of our physics to work. And that fluctuation of energy in the vacuum in quantum theory is extremely high. That means in quantum theory, when they say vacuum, they mean something not empty, but something extremely full of energy. It's called vacuum fluctuations,
yeah,
or vacuum energy. And it's in the order of 10 to the 94 grams per centimeter cubed. And just to give the listeners an idea, 10 to the 94 grams, or 10 to the 93 to 10 to the 94 grams per centimeter cubed, is more than if I took all of the stars we see in the universe, which is billions and billions of stars, and I squashed them all into a centimeter cube, I still wouldn't have the energy density of 10 to the 93 gram per centimeter cube.
Hmm. So it's...
When we're talking about the vacuum in quantum theory, we're talking about something that has extreme amount of energy.
Yeah.
Hmm. And you could think of it as extreme amount of information. And so I started to think of this structure of the vacuum as something that is not chaotic, but it is actually very highly structured. And that, you know, it's like an underlying geometry that creation emerges from and returns to. And the dynamics that we see in creation, like spin and electromagnetic field and all this other stuff we see, is actually just a function of the energy or the information moving from inside to outside and then back inside the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so right away, you know, a torus shape emerged, which is like a donut, you know, where the dynamics of spin and Coriolis effect would emerge going from the inside of the torus out and then back into the torus. I start to see the universe as not just an expanding universe, but as a contracting universe as well. And we just think it's expanding because we're on the expansion side.
Mm-hmm.
But if we were at the poles of it, it would be contracting if it's a torus. And I realized that because of Coriolis forces, there would be two toruses. So it would be like a sphere with two toruses in it, turning in the opposite direction. And when we look at the galaxy, that's exactly what we see. When we look at the plasma dynamics on the sun, that's what we see. Even the weather system on our planet produces a double torus structure.
Hmm. So,
and so
does that suggest, though, Nassim, that there is a specific size to the universe, then?
Yes, it does. It mm-hmm. says that our universe has a finite size, and that is a closed universe. And, you know, more and more data is supporting that now. Lately, data that has come from background radiation investigation has shown that our universe is most likely a torus, in fact.
Hmm.
So there's more and more evidence that this theory is solid. Actually, there's been, at this point, hundreds of different sets of data from astrophysics to subatomic experiments that has supported the veracity and the robustness of this theory. So it's very exciting.
Hmm. Very interesting. Why don't we talk a little bit about this aspect of spin or what you call the power of spin? You had this interesting, you know, where you laid out basically, if you asked astrophysicists today why everything in our universe is spinning, there is no real answer to that. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Meaning that they'll tell us, if you ask why is the Earth spinning, they'll say, well, because it's in the solar system, and the solar system and the sun is spinning. And then if you ask, well, what's making the sun spin, they'll say, oh, well, it's conserved from the galaxy. It's because the galaxy is spinning. And then you say, well, what's making the galaxy spin? And then eventually you get back to the Big Bang, and they say, oh, well, it all started in the Big Bang, which is the Big Bang theory is like, it's like the God of science. You know, in religions, they say God did everything. Well, in science, they just say the Big Bang did everything. But
right.
In both cases, it doesn't tell you anything about creation.
Hmm. And
so
if that was...
My view is that creation is occurring continuously. And that, you know, this description I was saying between what's going in and what's coming out, the dynamics, and you know that dynamics is even evident in your existence, in your day-to-day existence. You know, you eat things and that gives you energy, and then you do things on the outside of you, and that gives you information that goes back into you, and you interpret that information, and then you act upon it in a certain way outside, and that gives you more information that goes. And all this thing, like you can see that dynamic of the feedback between what goes in and what comes out everywhere. And the significance is that when this happens, the result is spin. And a good example for that is when you pull the plug on the tub after you've taken a bath. When you pull the plug, water starts to spin in. It doesn't just go in straight, it spins in.
Yeah.
And as water goes in, air comes out. There's an exchange. And so the exchange between the vacuum and what we call reality is the result of this information moving back and forth produce the spin that generates all of creation. And so I modified Einstein's equation to show that very dynamic being part of space-time itself, that space and time has this intricate, intrinsic spin embedded in it. It's called a torque, a force that brings everything into motion, that brings everything into spin. And that is the source of all of creation.
Fascinating. And of course, this, you know, this opens up many different areas, of course. But I mean, there are so many different things that this comes out of. For instance, you mentioned that in the vacuum there's information or energy then about. I guess that the information mainly is about how. What the structure is going to be next time it is expanding again. Is that correct, or is there anything more in that energy or in that information in the vacuum?
Basically that the vacuum is like a huge hard drive, which is everywhere, you know? And it gets, it's like impregnated with all of the information. It's in every atom. All atoms are mostly made out of vacuum. And basically, it's each atom is a little dot, a little point of infinite potential, infinite density, because it has the vacuum at its center. And let me explain that a little bit. If everything is a little torus, a little donut, or a double torus, like two donuts on top of each other spinning in the opposite direction, like an electron and a positron, or like a north and south pole on a galaxy, you can think of, like, what's in the middle of the torus? Well, the middle of the torus is the vacuum.
Yeah.
And so in the hole in the middle, basically in the vacuum, all of the information is transferred back and forth, going from the equator to the poles, back into the middle, and back out, and back into the middle, and back out. And on my website, I have a good animation of that. And what basically this does is that it, you know, the vacuum is like this incredible, infinite potential energy. And it has all the information embedded in it, like a huge hard drive. And then when the information comes out, it's a dynamic function of the hard drive, just like your active memory or the ROM on your computer. Now it's active, and it's gathering information, and then it feeds it back to the vacuum. It feeds it back to the hard drive so that all things know where all things are and what they're doing.
Right. So
that the vacuum can self-organize everything into existence.
This opens up the area of quantum communication and or even instant communication. We're constantly trying to, you know, go faster in space and things like this. We're building stuff to go faster and faster all the time. But eventually we're going to reach the point of entropy. You know, it's not going to go any faster. But would you say that this is an area that would open up a whole different new, technology, basically, if we look at space travel, for instance?
Yes, this is a technology of centropy instead of a technology of entropy.
Right.
And so basically what I'm saying is that the laws of physics are not wrong when they talk about entropy. They're just talking about one part of the feedback. The part that expands from the center, the radiation part, is entropic. But the part that goes back to the center is the part that's centropic, the part that creates before it radiates. And all this is in a feedback. There's not just the radiation part, but there's the contraction part into creation. And so, yeah, this opens the door. First of all, it opens the door to explaining many quantum weirdnesses, you know, like communication instantaneously along very long distances that have been proven in laboratories, and all sorts of nonlinear effects you find in quantum theory can easily be explained by the concept of a full vacuum that's exchanging between all particles. But as well, it does open the door to understanding how this energy works so that we can actually attach our technology to the will works of nature itself, the way nature works. Instead of fighting nature, work with nature, because it's highly successful at producing serious amount of energy. And so, you know, work with nature and be part of the will works of nature and attach your technology to it, and you'll have very, very large capacity to do things that would seem like miracles today.
Right, exactly. And the question here that obviously arises, I mean, scientists, they are trying to create, for instance, quantum computers that would open up the computer field, you know, incredibly much in regards to how fast we can process information and so forth. But the problem at this point seems to be how we can access this. I mean, is there any ideas out there or any ideas that you have at this point on how we can tap into this or gain, you know, access to this?
Yes. Well, the first thing is to really start to understand how it works. You can't just go in there blindly. And, you know, so in order to access it, in order to get there, in order to reach, to be able to create a link to it, we have to be able to understand its dynamics and understand how it works. How does it produce an atom? How does it create? And, you know, and for sure, part of that understanding is going to involve spin, because everything spins into existence. So right away, you know that whatever you're going to do to try to access it is going to have to involve spin, and it's going to have to, you know, be able to be in the right geometry so that space-time can start interacting with it and so on. So, yeah, it leads eventually to a deeper understanding of how this happens and how we can start to play the same game to harmonize with nature in order to extract whatever we need from nature, instead of thinking of our world as lacking and as being entropic, we can think of our world as having infinite amount of possibilities and infinite amount of energy. And, you know, and nature is not limited to, you know, very little amount of goods, you know, of resources. There's infinite amount of resources. We just got to understand how it works.
Indeed, and I mean, what you're saying there, then I guess we move into the area of the role of consciousness in all of this, because if we, I mean, if I'm hearing you correct here, it has to do with our perception of things as well. It has to do with our intent of you know, the system that we are a part of. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. It definitely has to do with perception and going beyond our five senses and realizing that there's an underlying fundamental force from which all of our experience emerges, and then to realize that we're part of that feedback. You know, that like consciousness in this theory can easily be explained by understanding that you know, in order for you to be self-aware, you need to have a feedback. For instance, you have to look at yourself in the mirror and know that it's you. And so basically, you know, what we call consciousness is actually that force of nature that goes out, gathers information, and brings it back in, and goes out, gathers information, and bring it back in. And you know, basically, you're like a probe of the vacuum, looking back at yourself and experiencing the vacuum and informing the vacuum of your experience. And then the vacuum is feeding you back experiences that you interpret and inform the vacuum about as well, and all this. Mm-hmm. And because you're experiencing the vacuum from one very specific point in the fractal structure of the vacuum, which is infinite, meaning that each point is the center, each point experiences in its own very specific, particular way, you are crucial to informing the universe about that very specific perspective. And so when we become aware of that, that we're part of this infinite feedback in space, then we can become active, conscious participant in it, and not only participate philosophically in the way we're thinking, in a way that brings us more of what we want and less of what we don't want, but we can apply this understanding to technology so that we can produce technology that interact with that feedback to give us everything we can ever dream of.
Hmm. Very interesting. So mankind, in a way, then, might be a result of the, well, if you will, the wish of the universe to understand itself. Is that correct?
Yes, in some ways you could think of it that way. I like to think of it as a branch of a fractal structure. And, you know, every individual is like the little teeny point on the end of that branch, experiencing, looking back at itself, looking back at the universe, and experiencing it from its own very specific point of view, and feeding a very specific set of information that is only very particular to them. And so the importance of every single individual is so crucial in this view. Like the universe, that we're not just irrelevant little dot that mean nothing, but that we're actually part of a very large will works of nature, in which we're playing a role in experiencing and forming the universe about our experience.
Hmm, fascinating. Hey, Nassim, I think this is a good place to round things up here for our first segment, and then I definitely want to ask you more about your DVD, Crossing the Event Horizon. I know that you touch upon a lot of different subjects in that DVD that we haven't gone into yet, things like the crop circles, for instance, and even going back to some of the scriptures that you mentioned in the beginning of the program. I definitely want to ask you more about that. But to round things up here for our first segment, tell us a little bit about your DVD, what it is about, and how people who are interested in finding out more about your research, how they can get a copy of this DVD.
Okay, yes. Well, you know, the DVD is basically, you know, I give seminars, and for some 15 years I've been giving seminars, and I've always been asked, you know, can we have this so we can study it, because my talks are typically 8 to 10 hours long, and there's so much information and so on, and it would be so much better for people to review it and so on. So eventually I produced a DVD, and you know, it's an edited version of my long seminar. It's still about 8 hours long. It's 4 DVDs in a set of DVD. It may be daunting, but actually it goes pretty fast, and in there, there's all of the details of this theory, what it means, this beautiful graphics that expresses it. It's very easy to understand. It's actually, you know, I have from housewives to, you know, very young kids to, you know, older people and so on. Anybody can understand it. And I think that's one of the beauty of this theory, is that it's intuitive and it's easily understood. And then I talk about all of the research I did in ancient civilization and what that means to our concept of our history and how science evolved and which part in science got missed and how is that going to change our world and how, you know, and the changes that are occurring in our world. And there's a bunch of special features on the DVD that are very important.
Brilliant. And I guess the easiest way to get a copy is to go to the resonanceproject.org. Is that correct?
That's correct. And you can buy it right online. And, you know, you can email us comments and all this, get on our email list. And as well, I do monthly phone calls in which people, after they've seen the DVD or if they have any questions and so on, they can ask me directly on these monthly phone calls. So there's a way for them to get their question answers, because the information is going to answer a lot of questions and it's going to raise a lot of questions. So
yeah.
I want it for people to have a way to ask those.
Okay, brilliant. Everyone do take a look at the resonanceproject.org. We're going to take a little break here and then continue talking more with Nassim in our member section. And we have a lot more to get into. But thank you very much for tuning in to this segment. And thanks to Fredrik behind the controls. So stay with us, Nassim, and we'll continue after this short break.
Thank you.